next year with the pure C2 gauge group. We were working on the U-plane. I'm trying to work out the precise form of the low energy effective Lagrangian. But I made a few statements which might have sounded contradictory. So the first statement I made is that at very large U, but the theory is semi-classical, I could compute the spectrum of particles of BPS particles, which is particles sitting in short representation of the supersymmetry algebra, and that there was a W boson with zero magnetic charge and electric charge too, and was a whole family of dions. That you obtain by quantization a classical monopole solution. Now, I also made a claim that out at infinity, you would see a monodromy in the U-plane, that if you went around the U-plane counterclockwise, you'd find a shift in tau, a shift in the theta angle due to the logarithm in the one loop correction to the gauge coupling. And correspondingly, there would be a shift in A and AD. And there will be a shift in the charges of a dion. So that the central charge would remain invariant. Now, this is not a problem in the sense that if I do this shift for the charges of one of the dions, I get another dion in the spectrum. So the spectrum is perfectly consistent with this monodromy. Now, on the other hand, I also told you that this monodromy really comes from the combination of the monodromies that radiate out of the two singularities in the U-plane. So there was a singularity where a particle of mass 1,0 became massless. The singularity of a particle of charge 1,2 became massless. And by the same token, because of the, I mean, I argue that there should be a monodromy around this singular point, where minus 1 over tau goes to minus 1 over tau minus 1. And A goes to A minus AD, which means QM goes to QM plus QE. Now, this should sound utterly bizarre to you, because it means that if I take my W boson and I carry it around the singularity, I should get another W boson with magnetic charge too. And then again, another W boson with magnetic charge 4, et cetera, et cetera. None of these particles is present in the spectrum. Actually, so if you look at what happens at 1,2n, well, it goes to another state with the same electric charge, but magnetic charge 2n plus 1. So unless n is equal to minus 1, you will be producing a new state, n equal 1 or 0. You will be producing a state that actually does not exist in the weak coupling spectrum. So you might start believing that maybe the picture I drew yesterday is contradictory. Now, On the other hand, you could also say, but why should I believe that the particles that exist in a certain region of the parameter space also exist in another region of the parameter space? Now, when I say the number of particles, as I mentioned yesterday, I really mean what I call omega gamma, which was a sum of the particles of charge gamma, so let me say a trace, on the Hilbert space of particles of charge gamma. So short BPS particles appear in these short multiplets. And I claim that if I do something like it is right. I claim that I could sum over the particles, something like minus one, the 2j, 2j. Let me just write it as a sum. So sum of all the BPS particles. All the BPS multiplets, if I add up this quantity is the quantity that appears in the one loop in the loop calculations when I integrate away a BPS particle. Now I mentioned that the one loop contribution of a particle which is not BPS cancels out. So the way it works is that if a particle is not BPS, the content of fields get another of these factors, which are called half upper multiplets. And you can see, for example, let me say this right. So you can rewrite this as a trace on the Hilbert space of minus 1 to the 2j, 2j squared. OK? So if you do this on this matter content, you will reproduce the number that appears in the one loop calculations. If you do it to this matter content, you will get zero. So this omega of gamma is a quantity that gives zero on long representations of the supersymmetry algebra, and it's non-zero only for short representations, which are the ones that satisfy the BPS bound. Now, if you have a particle, a BPS particle in the spectrum at some point in the moduli space, and you want to not have it at some other point in the moduli space, you have to assume that somehow its mass went beyond the BPS bound. Somehow, now this is okay, but if you do that, it will have to sit in a multiple supersymmetry, which is longer. So it will have to combine with other short multiplets to form a long multiplet. And then the contribution of these particles to the index would cancel out. So in a sense, this index does not see particles which have the possibility of pairing up with some particle to go away from the BPS bound. It only counts the number of irreducible, the reducible number of particles, the number of BPS particles which cannot disappear from the spectrum naively. So in other terms, this is an index. And is protected against small deformations of the theory. Now, these non-randomization theorems usually have a little loophole. So they work out if you're really allowed to talk about the spectrum of the Hilbert space of single particle states with a certain charge. Now, this works when you study BPS particles for a very simple reason. that if I have a particle of charge gamma, a central charge z gamma, it will have an energy equal to z gamma. Now, the continuum of states of the theory are basically scattering states. It means that they must have an energy which is at least the sum of the energies of two constituents. So the continuum for states of charge gamma starts at z gamma 1 plus z gamma minus gamma 1. So to say it in a way, to make a state in the continuum, you need to fraction this charge into several objects. Each of these objects, when they're very far away from each other, satisfy the BPS bound. And because this is strictly bigger, bigger than equal, z gamma 1 plus z of gamma plus gamma 1 minus gamma 1, which is the origin of z gamma, you see that the states in the continuum have typically a gap above the single particle states, the single particle BPS states, unless the phase of the central charge for two, unless these two complex numbers are aligned. So typically, if I look at my central charge, these complex numbers A, D, and M, and I look at all possible choices of charges, of integral charges, I get a lot of different complex numbers, but they all have different phases. This is one, and this is I pi. I'm not going to be able to get 2 plus I pi to the same phase as some other linear combination of I of 1 and I pi with the integral coefficients. Now, so as long as this continuum stays away from the Hilbert space of single particle states, then I can trust these neural normalization theorems that tell me that the index is constant. On the other hand, if I get to a point where the central charge of two, corresponding to two different charges, are aligned, then the continuum will come down and touch the Hilbert space, which I'm trying to study. And it's perfectly possible for some short representation to just disappear in the continuum. I mean, so as I said, in a sense, this index is a, right, if the continuum comes down and touches the Hilbert space, you're doing differences between infinities, and you can get finite numbers. So we expect that if the central charge of some particles align in this picture, some of these particles might disappear, and this might make this picture consistent with the monotonies. Now, if you actually look how the central charges of these particles are, if you start far away at infinity, so let me draw some useful pictures. Just need to understand where to draw them. Okay, so let's look at the space of central charges. Say that your W boson had a central charge, which was this vector. Now, so what you see, let me say this right. So remember that you had A, which was approximately square root of U over 2, and then you had AD, which was I over pi, A logarithm of A to the fourth, or lambda to the fourth. Okay? So it's very easy to get to situation. So say you could have A that is real, then AD would be pure imaginary, and would be much larger than A. So you will have a short vector. Sorry, I need a different blackboard, sorry. So if U is much bigger than lambda, you had this picture. You have the central charge of your W boson, the central charge of your monopole. And then all the other dions have a central charge, which is AD plus Shu and A. So you get a bunch of alkylos. An infinite set of alkylos corresponds to the particles 1,0, 1,2, 1,4, all the way to the W boson on one side and to the anti-W boson on the other side. Okay. Now, if you start moving in, towards the singularities, going a smaller u, what you find is that you will find actually a line where the phase of A and AD are instead aligned. Now, it's very easy to argue that such a line should exist, because remember that at this point, AD was zero. So if you look around this point, AD has whatever phase you want. And you're surely able to find one place, one direction locally where it's aligned with A, and one direction locally where it's aligned with minus A. And similarly here, AD plus 2A was zero. So it's again easy to predict that there should be at least one direction where AD plus 2A is aligned with A or with minus A. It takes a little bit of more effort to show that these lines actually join together into this sort of elliptic region. But it's something that you could check in principle given the explicit form of the periods. And also, we'll see that this is a consistent picture. Now, what happens when I approach this wall? So these are closed walls, just because they are codimension one in the moduli space. So let me call this place U plus, and the place just below the wall U minus. So as you approach U plus, what you see is that this bundle of line of central charges starts collapsing, because essentially most of the particles will either have a phase or the opposite phase for the central charges. So what's happening is that, say, the magnetic monopole on one side, and the 2,1 particle on one side, and the 1,2 particle on one side, and the 1,0 particle on the other, start moving towards the line of the W boson. Here, clearly I have the line for the minus 1,0. And here I have the line of the minus 1,2. So if you want the reason for which the line of the W boson lies in between these two lines is because 0,2 is the sum of 1,2 and minus 1,0. So the charge of W boson, the charge for all the infinite set of dions, are positive linear combinations of these guys. Now, Sabravitin argued then that, so also, if you think that here I must have made a wrong sign somewhere because I really want the peace. So notice that the particles that you have in the middle, W boson and all the others, are all particles that you would not like to see after the monodromy. They are all the particles which under the monodromy go to some other charges which you know don't exist in theory. On the other hand, the extreme values, 1,2 and 1,0, are the particles which go to particles which still exist under the monodromy. So Sabravitin conjectured that as you cross that wall, what happens is simply that, so on the wall, all these lines collapse together. All these particles can be are aligned. And you can imagine that maybe all of these particles can mix with multi-particle states made out of several of these particles. For example, the W boson could mix with the 2-particle states in the continuum made of out of one of these particles and one of these particles. As a result, on the other side of the wall, so on the other side, if the central charges keep changing on the other side of the wall, their position will be interchanged. So Sabravitin conjectured that inside this region, the spectrum really consists of, I understand why. I'm sorry. There is a little sign mistake in what I wrote there and in the pictures I drew. Just bear with me and essentially I drew the pictures that correspond to having drawn these monodromy lines. No big deal. Okay, so they claim that only these 2 particles will survive plus the antiparticles inside this region of modular space. Now, if you accept this assumption, you keep now going all the way to the other wall. Well, you cross this monodromy line, so the labels of your particles, the charges of your particles are relabeled. 1,2 goes to -1,2. Or 1,-2. Well, this one isn't affected. And so what happens is that these lines keep rotating. So here we have exchanged these 2 lines. And as you keep rotating these lines, now we get to cross each other. This was the -1,0 line. This was the -1,2, which has been relabeled to a 1,-2. Okay, so now when these central charges meet, a multiparticle state made out of this particle and this particle could actually create your W boson here, because you see the sum of the charges is 1-2 plus -1,0. You get 0,-2. So the idea is that now you cross this wall and you recreate the infinite spectrum of particles that you have a weak copy. So there is a consistent picture. And it's also consistent with all sorts of relabelings and monodromies. So the picture is that you have a strong coupling when U is very small. Somehow this theory at low energy has only the massless gauge fields and 2 massive particles with magnetic charges, the original W boson is completely disappeared, and W boson is a so it's really here. W boson should be seen as sort of a composite. Well, it doesn't exist anymore. Near the wall, the W boson appears as a composite of these two particles. Now, you can draw similar pictures for an F equal to 1, an F equal to 2 for more flavor. They become pretty Byzantine because, for example, once you have a mass parameter, then you have all sorts of lines where, and walls where particles with various charges and flavor charges can align the central charges. It becomes pretty time consuming to try to guess the correct spectrum in various locations of the moduli space. Although for these simple theories, SU2 theories, typically with one-dimensional moduli space, typically you can get to guess the spectrum from requiring consistency with all possible monotomies. Okay. So the problem of wall crossing is the problem of being able to predict which particles are created or destroyed across the wall. So here we had a strong coupling, these two particles, and somehow they created this infinite tower of particles when you cross the wall. The main property of these particles, that if I call their charges gamma 1, 1,0, and gamma 2, 1,-1, and if I do the synthetic product of charges, which is QE1, QM2, sorry, QM1, QE2, minus QM2, QE1, you will get, I guess this is really ENM, sorry. You will get 2. And in all the something that somehow had actually not been noticed originally, but as we'll see very, very, very shortly, had to be true, is that it all in these other more complicated examples with flavor, whenever at a wall you had particles whose charge, on one side of the wall you had two particles whose charge satisfied this constraint and whose central charges met, on the other side of the wall you always find an infinite tower of particles. With a very specific pattern of charges. You would always find W boson whose charge was gamma 1 plus gamma 2, and a tower of dions whose charge was gamma 1 plus multiples of gamma 1 plus gamma 2. And also you find in the examples with flavor, you find a lot of some walls with this property. And so you also find other walls where you have gamma 1, gamma 2, equal to 1. And across those walls, you typically have gamma 1 and gamma 2 on one side, and gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 1 plus gamma 2 on the other side. So definitely there are patterns there. It feels like, in principle, you could have thought that because the number of BPS particles definitely is a quantity that the infrared theory does not know. So there is no way for the infrared theory to know that there are these monopoles and these dions at recoupling. This is an information that came from the ultraviolet non-abelian gauge theory. And in a sense, right, all that was the spectrum of BPS particles together with the Lagrangian of the infrared abelian gauge fields is all that you see in the infrared of the non-abelian gauge theory. Now, it's surprising then that you should be able to say something about how the spectrum of particle changes across walls just from information like the infrared charges of the particles and the central charges of the particles. For a while, people didn't think about wall crossing formulae just because it seemed like the number of BPS states was a quantity that was just determined from the ultraviolet theory. So you wouldn't expect to have simple rules based on the infrared data to understand how the BPS pack degeneracy would jump. Instead, if you look carefully, you start seeing these patterns. And maybe a way to understand it is that although the BPS states themselves are very, hard, tiny cores of non-abelian dynamics, the ones that are decaying across the wall are mixing with multi-particle states. So if I want a state to mix with a with a loose bound state, if I want a state on this side of the wall to be represented as a, to disappear on the other side by mixing with the continuum, it should be true, at least morally, that this state looks like some loosely bound of true components, which gets lost on the other side of the wall. Now, if it's a loosely bound state of true components, its properties should be describable by the infrared. I mean, these two components will interact with the fields in the infrared Lagrangian. So you might expect that maybe the wall crossing will be described only by the infrared data. Now, this reasoning is not very tight. In field theory, it is pretty challenging to make it precise. In supergravity, it was done better. So wall crossing is also a common phenomenon in supergravity, in impulse supergravity, in Calabi-Yau compactifications of string theory. So when you study Calabi-Yau compactifications of string theory, you have particle-like objects in four dimensions, which are really D-brains, supersymmetric D-brains, wrapping cycles inside your Calabi-Yau. You can, in principle, count the number of such particles that you get in the four-dimensional theory by looking at the Euler character of certain complicated moduli spaces of vector bundles or sheaves or whatnot on the Calabi-Yau. And now, so in supergravity, you can make this argument too that you would have wall crossing. And then this wall crossing, which seems to be determined only by the properties of the supergravity compactification of the things like the central charge, again, the charges, is telling you something intricate about these complicated moduli spaces of sheaves, of vector bundles, or whatnot. So the computation of the number of bound states in the supergravity Calabi-Yau compactifications of string theory is actually apparently quite interesting problem mathematically. And so the wall crossing ideas started filtering in the mathematical literature. And then they came back with a vengeance. In the sense that two years ago, two mathematicians, Konsiewicz and Soberman, were studying some very abstract mathematical structure called motivic Donaldson-Thomas invariance. And this mathematical structure encoded a lot of the properties that you would expect to be true for the moduli spaces of sheaves on the Calabi-Yau, for the counting of BPS particles in supergravity. And they managed to produce a formula, a very simple, conceptually very simple formula, which in principle would be able to predict the full spectrum on one side of a wall if you know the spectrum on the other side. The formula doesn't look like anything that would come out of physics in a natural way, and I will describe it to you in a moment. And so one team of my research in the last couple of years have been really trying to understand how would it come out physically. So this has been done in collaboration with Greg Moore and Andy Neiske. So the appearance of this wall crossing formula, as I was saying, is quite interesting. So essentially, they consider someone define some operators, certain coordinate transformations, K gamma, I will write them down in a moment, and associate to each line in this plane the corresponding operator. Okay? So the operators are labeled by the charges in your abelian theory. Now, as I was saying, this the work of Osevich and Solomon in principle applies to this motivic Donaldson Thomas invariance for Calabi-Yau trifolds. But in practice, it turns out to predict perfectly well the world crossing in field theory. So that's actually, I would say, the big surprise. So here you have an infinite set of these operators associated with this infinite set of lines. Here you have two operators. And the claim is that the composition of these two operators is the same as the composition of these operators. So, so in this very simple example, we had two particles on one side and three particles on the other side. You get to write a formula, k gamma 1, k gamma 2, equal k gamma 2, k gamma 1 plus gamma 2, k gamma 1. So they define some operators which do not commute. And then the commutation, if you associate each of these operators to these lines, which tell you the direction of the central charges for the particle. And then when the lines try to cross each other, these operators try to commute with each other, but they do not commute. And so on the right-hand side, you get more stuff. So when gamma 1, gamma 2 is 1, you get a formula like this. In this other case, you will get something like k gamma 1, k gamma 2, equals k gamma 2, k gamma 2 gamma 2 plus gamma 1, k 3 gamma 2 plus 2 gamma 1, all the way to. Now, these operators should be raised to the power of the number of PPS particles with charge. So remember, this omega was 1 for the hypermultiplets. It was 2 for the W boson, because the W boson had that extra, had j equal to 1/2. So you get k gamma 1 plus gamma 2 to the minus 2, and then you get another infinite set of operators all the way to k gamma 1. And these operators are really just a coordinate transformation for some formal variables. So you define some formal variables, x gamma, with the property that x gamma tilde equals to minus 1 to the gamma gamma tilde, x of gamma plus gamma tilde. Okay? And then you define the operator by the following coordinate transformation. So as I was saying, this looks utterly bizarre. What are these variables? What is this transformation? Why would it turn out into an equal to which theory? But let me now show you a couple of examples. So if you apply this transformation, if you use this form for the transformation, you recover this sort of relations. And actually, so if I tell you that I have a certain product in one order of k gammas to the omega gamma, where the lines all line a certain sector V, there is a unique way to rewrite it as a product in the other order of k gamma to omega gamma tilde. So this formula is really a constructive way to predict the spectrum on one side of the wall, out of the spectrum on the other side of the wall. So for example, in the case with two or three lines, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 1, plus gamma 2, gamma 2. I hope I'm not getting the order wrong. I often do that mistake. So in one direction, I could take, I start with x gamma 1, x gamma 2, then I cross the wall. These variables are transformed to x gamma 1 and x gamma 1 plus x gamma 1, gamma 2, well, sorry, gamma 1 plus gamma 2. Then I cross the other wall and x gamma 1 goes to x gamma 1 over 1 minus x gamma 2. And I'm not sure it's actually so you and say x and this other one goes to x gamma 1 over 1 minus x gamma 2. X gamma 2. So if you start with the original variables and you go across the lines, you get, you know, certain intricate rational functions of the axis. And then you can try to do the transformations in the other side, in the other order. And when you get at the end, you get magically the same result. And it is really non-trivial. So if you try to understand how the product of these two becomes the product of these three, so I don't want to show all the intricacies of the calculation, but there is a sort of simplified version of the relations, which is very neat. So suppose you study the sequence xn plus 1, xn minus 1, equals to 1 plus xn. Suppose you have this recursion relation. And I start with x0, then x1, then I have x2, which is 1 plus x1 over x0. Then I have x3, which is 1 plus x2, so 1 plus 1 over x0 plus x1 over x0 over x1. And then I get x4, which is equal to 1 plus this, 1 plus 1 over x1 plus 1 over x0 x1 plus 1 over x0 divided by x2, 1 plus x1 over x0, which simplifies nicely and gives you x0 over x1 plus plus x1. Sorry, plus 1 over x1. And then finally, you get x5. Equals 1 plus x0 over x1 plus 1 over x1 over 1 plus 1 over x0 plus x1 over x0 all over x1. So you get back x1. Sorry, you get back x0. Yes, you get back x0. And x6 gives you back x1. So this funny sequence has a period 5. Whatever are the true original values, they come back after 5 steps. And so by using the fact that it is a period 5, you can easily show that if you do these two operations here, it's the same as doing these three operations here. The sort of transformations that you use are of this, more or less of this general form. So this is sort of a pentagon relation. Similarly, you can study the behavior of the sequence xn plus 1, xn minus 1 equal to 1 plus xn squared. Distance is not periodic, but if you look at the, so if you start with some values at 0, x0 and x1, and you look at what you get at plus infinity or minus infinity, you find that the values at plus infinity and minus infinity are actually related. And if you stare at it long enough, you realize that it gives you a proof that these infinite products of transformations together with this funny relation in the middle, which is one that relates sort of plus and minus infinity in the sequence, give a simple expression. So there seems to be a lot of entertaining algebra hidden behind these world-crossing relations. These sort of things are called cluster transformations, and mathematicians have been having fun with them for a while. And so some of the relations you get from gauge theory are pretty standard set of cluster transformations, and some other ones are not. So at this point, we had this funny world-crossing formula. We see that there is a lot of fun algebra behind it, but it's unclear what physics is there behind it. How would they get out of field theory some a formula like this? Now, 1 year ago, we produced a proof, but it was based on a very intricate, very long circle of ideas. Recently, we realized that it was a very much simpler way to understand it, so I would like to present that. So in order to prove the world-crossing formula, we need to talk about line operators, supersymmetric line operators in the gauge theory. So what is a supersymmetric line operator? Well, a line operator is something like a Wilson line operator, a toothed loop operator. So it's a sort of codimension tree defect that lives on a line inside your spacetime. A supersymmetric line operator is a line operator which preserves some amount of the original supersymmetries of your theory. So our theory had 8 supercharges. I would like to study half BPS line operators to preserve 4 out of 8 supercharges. Now, because the supercharges commute translations, you've got to be careful, because the line operator clearly breaks translations in 3 out of 4 directions. But if your line operator is a straight line, say extended a long time, then you might be able to preserve a set of supercharges that commute to the translation along the line operator. And it's not difficult to write such a set of supercharges. You can take the holomorphic supercharges and combine it with the anti-holomorphic supercharges, Karras supercharges, and combine it with the anti-Karras supercharges with the help of a gamma matrix. So the commutator of the anti-commutator of two of these supercharges gives you back P naught. So the supercharges commute to the translations along the line operator, which I've placed a long time. Actually, if you take into account the fact that the theory in infrared has a central charge, you get an extra contribution from Q anticommutator to Q and Q bar anticommutator to Q bar. Sorry, here I should have put a zeta. And you get something like this. By the way, this zeta should be a phase for a physical. If you want to have a sort of an Hermitian set of supercharges, this A should be a phase, although it is sometimes useful to analytically continue it to the complex plane. So this here could be written as P naught plus the real part of Z over zeta, or Z e to the I half, say e to the minus I half. OK, so this means that in presence of the line operator, our theory still has a BPS bound. The energy is bound to be bigger than the real part of z e to the I alpha. But the BPS bound is weaker than the one we had in the bulk theory. Because in the bulk theory, the energy was bounded from below by the absolute part of the central charge, not the real part. So this means that when you study the Hilbert space of the theory in the presence of this line operator, there will be states which presumably saturate this BPS bound and preserve some supercharges. And there will be a continuum of scattering states where bulk particles just glance from the line operator. But this continuum will be very well separated from the, set of ground states, just because the ground states, a ground state of charge gamma far away has a has an energy of a real part of z gamma over e to the minus I alpha. While a scattering state with a bulk particle far away from the from your line operator and a state of charge gamma minus gamma 1 at the operator will have an energy that is approximately real part of z gamma minus gamma 1 to the I alpha plus absolute value of z gamma 1. So you have a discrete set of ground states, and then there is above it a continuum that is well separated. So you can guess that you can now play again the same game of defining some index which counts the number of ground states in the presence of the line operator. We called it a we call this framed BPS degeneracies. Not sure it's a particularly useful name or a particularly useful symbol, but still working on it. they're the trace on the Hilbert space of bound states to the line operator with charge gamma of just minus 1 to the f. This is because the because now the supersymmetry algebra has less supercharges. The multiplets of the supersymmetry algebra are actually simpler. So the ground states have a zero on the right-hand side, so they're just killed by all supercharges. The non-ground states sit in a multiple of 2 to the 2 states, which is, is this usual actual zero plus 1/2 tensor J, which is killed by this trace. So now we define new numbers, new integral numbers. Why are they interesting? Well, let's ask what is wall crossing for these states. Now, wall crossing happens only if this continuum touches down the ground states. Now, this means that it only happens if the absolute value of z gamma 1 equals the real part of z gamma 1 e to the I alpha minus I alpha. Which is to say that the phase of the central charge for this bulk particle should be aligned with this phase alpha. Now, before I continue, So if I was, if I do had the ability of building some line operators for any value of the phase I want, then I can try to vary the value of this phase continuously and ask how the frame BPS degeneracies behave as a function of alpha. And I expect to see wall crossing only when alpha aligns with one of the with the central charges of one of the BPS particles. So in a sense, this makes these pictures rather more concrete. If I'm in a theory where only these two particles exist, these four particles exist, and I study a line operator, the BPS degeneracies of this line operator let me just call them omega L for degeneracies associated with line operator L will jump only across these lines. On the other hand, if I keep alpha fixed and I move in the u-plane, nothing happens to this frame because degeneracies, because no central charge of bulk particles is aligning with alpha on the wall. The only thing that happens on these walls up there is that the central charges of different bulk particles align. So omega will be the same on this side of the picture, on the other side of the wall. What changes, presumably, is a sequence of waves, is the way the omegas change to go from here to here. Because here, now they have to change across all these lines, but then somehow come back to here. So if I can define some object, K gamma, which tells me how omega changes across line, this sequence of objects, if I concatenate these transformations along these lines here, I should get the same result as if I concatenated here. So you can see that I might be able to get a wall crossing formula just by studying the way the frame BPS degeneracies change across walls of marginal stability. Now, then at this point, I'm helped by some other important phenomenon. The fact that the only part, if I go near to these values of alpha, so I expect some states in the continuum to mix with my ground states, but only of this particular continuum that is coming down, which is the continuum of objects of this form, where I have a hard core and many one or more particles of charge gamma 1 far away, forming a loose bound state. And these particles of charge gamma 1, just because they have the same charge or aligned charge, some of them might have charge 2 gamma 1, 3 gamma 1, whatever, they don't feel each other. The attraction, the electromagnetic repulsion, is completely cancelled by the attraction mediated by the scalar fields of your equal to low energy infrared gauge theory. So, if you want, it's like studying an atom, the orbitals of an atom, in an approximation where the electrons don't see each other. All you need to do is to find the spectrum of hydrogen, you know, the spectrum of one electron sitting in the background on the nucleus. And then you get a Fock space of states when you populate these ground states with many electrons. So you get to the prediction that these Hilbert spaces of frame states gain or lose Fock spaces as you cross these lines. Fock spaces constructed out of the bound states of a particle of charge gamma 1 to a core. So this problem can now be studied in the infrared gauge theory. You can take the fields sourced by this core, write down a probe action for this particle, and just check if you can find the bound state or not. An almost identical calculation was done a few years ago by the NEF in the context of supergravity. And it was indeed used by the NEF and Moore to study some partial results on wall crossing. Now we need to repeat it in field theory, but it's not that different. So I would like to give you a few small details of the calculation. Not too much. So the fields that are sourced by an object of charge gamma. So to give you the fields that are sourced by an object of charge gamma, I should give you the value of A as a function of the radius. Okay. The A satisfies pretty nonlinear differential equations. But it turns out that the solution is actually rather simple for field configurations that preserve supersymmetry. So for BPS field configurations, you can write down first order equations that can actually be immediately integrated. And so you get this sort of formula that the real part of A e to the I alpha equals the real part of A at infinity e to the I alpha plus let me say this right. The magnetic charge over X. So this is only half of the equations that you need. So this is fixing the real part of A. And instead of getting an equation for the imaginary part of A, you get an equation for the real part of AD. So this looks like a lot like a Cantor equation of supergravity. You have seen them.
Yeah, in general, the general formula is that the real part. So you can define the central charge as a function of the position as well. And the general formula is that the real part of the central charge as a function of the position e to the I alpha is the value at infinity plus gamma, gamma tilde, or x, if you're sending the charge down. Okay? The probe action for the particle for slow motion of the particle, I can use a. It's essentially the coupling to the scalar fields and the coupling to the gauge fields.
The scalar fields couple to the particles in a very simple way. They affect the mass of the particles. So the mass of the particles, but of course the gamma, the function of x. And then there is the electromagnetic interaction. And it turns out that with a little bit of algebra by using the BPS conditions, you can rewrite this as something as like the imaginary part of z gamma e to the I alpha. So in a sense, you have a particle which is moving in a potential, which is the difference between the absolute value and the imaginary part of z gamma. So the potential graphically takes two possible form shapes. So essentially, if you look again in the alpha. In the plane of center charges, on one side of the BPS line, you get this picture. And on the other side of the BPS line, you get this picture. So you see that on one side of the BPS line, your particle is simply unbound. On the other side of the BPS line, your particle has classically a minimum. And you can actually quantum mechanically find a ground state there with the correct energy.
Well, this, you know, what's in front of integral of ES is going to be potential felt by the
function. It seems to be dependent on the position.
No. So this is this is a function of the radius.
Why is it not inside the integral?
Sorry?
Why it is not inside the integral?
Again?
Why the potential is not inside the integral?
Sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. So, yeah, the mass is position dependent, it goes inside. So you really see that just on one side of the wall, you will have unbound states. On the other side of the wall, you have bound states. So these are the bounds that you're losing as you cross the wall. It's actually interesting to notice that this distance, the distance from the line operator, is arbitrarily large if you're very close to the line. In a sense, the distance goes to infinity as you move towards the line. But as soon as you move on the other side, the distance becomes rapidly very small. So this description as a loose bound state to the line operator is actually valid on a thin region around the BPS line. Away from BPS lines, there are no loose bound states. Everything is, you know, very hard cores sitting around the line operator. So this description is just barely sufficient to study wall crossing, but it is sufficient. So, for example, right.
Can you please clarify, so line operators are characterized by gamma and alpha?
No, line operators are characterized by some label L. These are the line operators of the ultraviolet theory. And I'm going to discuss what labels to be given.
But I thought on that picture you were saying there are four lines and they correspond to these charges, 1, 0, 1, 2.
So these are the lines at which bulk particles can bind or unbind from your line operator. So if the line operator in the ultraviolet theory, and you put it in the origin, you see it in your infrared, you see it very far away. From very far away, what you see there is an object with a certain infrared charge.
So
alpha also characterizes the line operator.
It characterizes both.
Yes.
Gamma and alpha.
No, L and alpha.
What is gamma? Sorry.
No, gamma is there. So if you put your line operator, it's a perturbation that you test, like a whistle. In the first line operator, your theory has some bound states or finite values. So in the infrared, what you see from far away is the charge of those bound states. That's gamma. So gamma is not the charge of the line operator. The line operator was defined in ultraviolet. Knows nothing about the infrared charge, the charges in the infrared.
So to compute gamma, you really need to go outside.
You don't compute gamma. You.
So what is gamma? If you know L and alpha, how do you compute gamma?
Suppose you wanted to know the number of ground states of magnetic charge 1 in the presence of the line operator. So you take the space of monopole configuration at weak coupling. You take the space of monopole configurations in the presence of this line operator. For example, this could have been a singular tooth loop, a singular monopole. So this would be the model space of smooth monopoles in the presence of a singular one. You look at for ground states there. You count them, and this would be omega of one charge 1 plus 0. Then you repeat the exercise for configurations of charge 2, and you get an omega of charge 2, etc. So an intuitive way to understand that is that if you have a line operator in ultraviolet and you look at it in the infrared theory, what you see is some linear combination of the line operators of your infrared theory. But I'm not sure that's a useful intuition at the moment. So gamma was a label in infrared theory. It's a label that is attached to the one. The Hilbert space, the infrared theory, is created by gamma. States in the infrared theory are labeled by the charge mesh infinity. This is true for states in the bulk theory. It's still true for states in the presence of the line operator. So I can use gamma to label the states, and I can look at the degenerates of ground states, charge gamma.
So you're saying for a given line operator, there could be many states labeled by
gamma? Or many different charges. Sorry.
Yeah.
So sometimes the situation is simple. You know, it's perfectly possible for a loop operator for a single count state of a given charge, but it's a rare. It's not there. So it might happen here, and then you go across the wall, and it's not true anymore. Yes.
On this language, when you apply to line operators with along the time direction, is there along the space direction?
Well, you can still do quantization in that direction. You can actually use, so this is actually useful to study the line operators. If you quantify the time here in the circle, you can take line operators up in that circle and the computations about them. But yeah, it is always to do quantization in that direction. Anyway, what I want to say now is that suppose that I define a generating function. So I introduce some form of variables x gamma that measure the charge states and then build the generating function. I can ask how does the generating function transform across a wall? So see, if I had a single term x gamma on one side of the wall in the generating function, on the other side I'm going to get a lot of terms corresponding to the full Fock space. Of states. So it turns out that the number of ground states depends on the charges of your core and of the particle. Simply because if I have a core with magnetic charge here and a particle with electric charge here, there is a pointing vector that goes rotates around this line from from the electric field wedged the magnetic field. So in other words, whenever I have a dionic configuration with a certain extent, I get an angular momentum captured in the fields. So if I'm studying the ground states of an electron in the presence of a monopole, so if I quantize the electron living on this sphere in the presence of a monopole field in the middle, I get a ground state, which is a representation of the angular momentum with J equal to 1/2 gamma 1, gamma 2. Sorry, gamma 1. Now, the bulk particle actually sits in a multiplet of spin. Remember, there are some set up a multiplet that both has scalars and fermions. It turns out that the ground state, in the ground state, the spin of this particle is 1/2 and is up aligned against the orbital angular momentum. So the number of states is something like gamma 1. And this would be fermionic or bosonic, depending on this being even or odd. So at the end of the story, if I just build my Fock space, suppose that say gamma 1 was 1, I have a fermionic Fock space generated by a single state. So if I have x gamma on one side, I have x gamma plus x gamma plus gamma 1 on the other side, if gamma 1 was 1. If gamma 1 was 2, Because there is as I said, the spin of this particle is actually aligned against the orbital momentum, so the overall J is actually this minus 1/2. So you see, if the particles have local charges, say true electric and electric, they just don't attack each other, there's no ground state. The first ground state appears if you have a monopole of charge 1 and an electron of charge 1. So the independence of the charges was true, you get the Fock space with two states inside. X gamma plus 2x gamma plus gamma 1 plus x gamma plus 2 gamma 1, etc. And it's not hard to convince yourself that this formula here is exactly measuring the variation of the Hilbert spaces. It's only just telling that if you had a state of charge and material on one side, on the other side you get a full Fock space with gamma tilde generators. This minus one factor here and this minus one factor here are picked in such a way that all the fermion numbers work out at the end. Okay. So we proved the Wolkowski formula. I don't know if this sounds straightforward to you, but it was way more straightforward than whatever the old proofs we had. For the whole time I talked about line operators in an abstract way. Maybe I should try to make it more concrete, tell you what do I mean with line operators. That's an operator. So, the simplest possible example of a line operator is the Wilson loop. So to define a Wilson loop, you discern the part order exponential of a gauge field along the whatever path in space-time. Now, this is not a supersymmetric object, but x dot ps, forgot dot and ds. So this is not supersymmetric. For the supersymmetric variation of this, it will act on A and give you some fermions. But you can cancel the supersymmetric variation if you put inside a scalar in the same multiplicative gauge field. So this was done first by Maldacena in Nicol Fossa per Mills. So you want to add a real scalar. We call it phi 1. Probably with an I. And forget. Or not. Anyway. So we have two scalars to pick among, right? Because we have a complex scalar in each vector multiplet. So we actually have a certain freedom in deciding which scalar we put in here. And so what we can do is we can put real part of phi e to the I alpha, where phi is the complex scalar. So you see that you can make a Wilson loop, which depends on the parameter alpha. And if you check which supersymmetries are observed by this Wilson loop, these are exactly the supersymmetries which I wrote down on the blackboard here. So essentially what's happening, it's very simple. The supersymmetry transformation of A will give you, with say Q, gives you the fermion and cancels out the transformation of phi under Q bar. And the gamma naught over there corresponds to the fact that here, I didn't want to just have any direction. I was really putting my Wilson loop a long time. Yes, that's right. I should have put the
Thank you. So this is an example of line operator. So you might ask now, okay, so if I put a line operator in my ultraviolet cage theory in the origin, if I put a Wilson loop, what am I going to see in the infrared? So very naively, you might expect to see some electric charges there in the infrared theory. But it's perfectly possible for some monopoles to have extra bound states in the presence of the Wilson loop. Another example of a line operator is, so this was Wilson. Or Wilson, or Maldacena Wilson. Then there is the toothed loop. The toothed loop is defined as a modification of the path integral for your theory. You impose that your fields, instead of being smooth everywhere, have a very specific singularity at the origin, and you only integrate over fluctuations, which are normalizable. So the toothed loop is defined by giving magnetic charge. On the sphere, magnetic flux on the sphere surrounding your point. So for an abelian theory, you just do this. For a non-abelian theory, you need to pick an embedding of U1 inside your theory. You need to decide which coefficient to put here. This has to be a weight of a co-weight of your gauge theory. This should correspond to an embedding of U1 inside your gauge group. And again, if you want to make it supersymmetric, you need to just satisfy the classical BPS equations. So all you really need is for phi to also have a singularity there proportional to W. So these supersymmetric toothed loops were introduced by Kapustin. So again, I don't know, maybe I should call them Kapustin toothed loops. And his original interest was to study the behavior of these toothed loops and the residuality in Nikiforov square mills. So there are Wilson loops, there are toothed loops. Also, in the presence of toothed loop, you can still add a Wilson loop in the part of the gauge group which is unbroken by the toothed loop. And so Kapustin found out that he could classify them in terms of the weight lattice of the theory, I wrote Px. So this must be computed in some representation of your gauge group. This is labeled by weight. And then you can take a co-weight, which labels the toothed loop part, and you identify under the action of the wild group. So this was the labeling of possible supersymmetric line operators in the ultraviolet gauge theory. So the label L, same, pure residual, leave it inside the space. And so, yes. Well, if one of the two factors is zero, you get a pure Wilson loop or a pure toothed loop. Now, in any of those pure mills, you have S duality, and if SL to Z is duality, inactive really is an SL to Z, adding or subtracting these two charges. So now you might want to study this set of line operators in the theories we defined in our first lecture, check if they behave well under duality, and then maybe try to compute the BPS degeneracies for those theories by studying these line operators. So, for example, the immediate fact was proven by Dr. Okuda Morrison that if you consider your A1 theory, find the sort of generalized quivers with the C2 gauge groups, and you look at the corresponding Riemann surface, this set of objects is the one-to-one correspondence with the closed curves on the Riemann surface. So, the sort of Riemann surface language that we introduced in the first lecture seems to agree very well with the
classification of line operators in the theory. And then you can imagine that S duality, which just acts as a mapping cluster to the surface, will act beautifully in the set of labels. And so, yeah, one last thing I would say is that these line operators actually form a ring, because if you place a line operator here and a line operator here, you take the expectation value. It's easy to show by using supersymmetry associated with several line operators that the result is independent of the distance. So, in a sense, there is no singularity in the OPE when you bring two line operators together. You can find a nice ring. Which was studied by in theoretical theories, for example, by Kapustin and Natalia. And this ring structure has some beautiful relation with this with the sort of expressions. Because in a sense, as we are computing the index, the number of bound states to a line operator, which is the superposition of two line operators, can be computed equally well when the two line operators are very far from each other. So roughly, you get to the result that the generating functions for the product of line operator is the product of the generating functions for the line operators. So so the structure of this ring was rather interesting in the concrete examples of the study, but it's very hard to determine. That's right. For n equal true, becomes much harder to determine, and it seems to depend strongly on the theory you're looking at, on the matter content. And so here you relate the problem of understanding this ring to the problem of understanding these BPS degeneracies. And notice that these BPS degeneracies are very, very constrained by the wall crossing formula. Because, in a sense, as you go around your, if you suppose that if your formula tells you that you had to have a Fock space on one side of the line, you better have the Fock space. So if you give me a generic generating function at random, and I start crossing walls, very soon I get contradictions. Like the wall crossing form will tell me that I had to have some Fock space there, but the Fock space was not in the generating function you gave me. So in concrete examples we were studying, looks like the just knowing the bulk spectrum characterizes in a very tight way the allowed generating functions for the ultraviolet line operators. In a sense, it classifies the line operators in the ultraviolet just in terms of the spectrum, the infrared spectrum of the bulk theory, which is quite amusing. So you can get predictions for the spectrum of line operators even in theories where you didn't have a Lagrangian to work with. And you can even compute these ring relations because you know the generating functions. So this is a work in progress, almost completed. Okay, any questions? Thank you.